As many of you know, I've just been away for 3 weeks. I've been going to do some teaching in Melbourne and Sydney. I managed to complete 35 talks in 22 days. So, good fun being a monk. If you ever want to see the world, become a monk or a nun, because next week I'm also going to Cambodia and Malaysia to give some more talks. By doing that, actually you get incredible amounts of energy. Sometimes that one doesn't realize that on the outside it might seem that's very, very tiring. But on the inside, whenever you're doing anything which is good, which is serving others, you always get heaps and heaps of energy back in return. And that's what always keeps me going for giving talk after talk after talk. In fact, as soon as I came back from Melbourne and Sydney on Wednesday afternoon, straight back to give a talk to the monks afterwards. So actually it was only last night I didn't give a talk, and I was suffering from withdrawal symptoms last night. So I'm glad to be back here on a Friday to give more talks. So this evening's talk, somebody gave me a suggestion of talking about, they said they've got the boss from hell. And if you've got a boss from hell, or a partner from hell, or a body from hell, this is actually how you're going to deal with it. It's how to deal with hell. In other words, not hell in some metaphysical state after death, but some of the experience we have to do in this life. But to begin the talk, I want to put this talk in perspective. It's also to explain why I talk about Buddhism in this way, to keep it into practical terms of some of the problems we have in life. Because in theoretical Buddhism, we sometimes have this dichotomy, these two ways of practice called samatha and vipassana. Those are the old Pali terms, but they're used so often amongst Buddhists, especially practicing Buddhists, that they've got a meaning almost of their own. In brief, that samatha means calm, tranquilizing, settling things down, whereas vipassana means insight, wisdom, understanding, no views. And sometimes that some people want to incline towards one against the other. And there is often there's a debate in some Buddhist circles, not all, certainly not here, because of hopefully the way we presented Buddhism over these years. There should never be any argument about these things, because really they are two sides of the same process. Now that process of calming, 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 is the same process which I'm going to talk about tonight, about calming the mind when one is dealing with difficulties and problems like the boss from hell, the partner from hell, or the body from hell. It's a way of dealing with problems, to settle them down, make them peaceful and still, so there's no problem anymore. That's actually what the word samatha means. It's marvelous being a monk who actually lives this life, because you find the meaning of these words in your daily practice. You know, I always mention to people that in the monk's rules of discipline, it's 227 rules, many people have heard that, but the last seven of those rules are the ways of settling the business in the monastic community. And the word they use for settling is samatha, calming the business down, which gives a good meaning of what that term is, settling problems. Vipassana is all the insight, the wisdom and the understanding teachings. And sometimes that people like to focus on like the insight. So what the wisdom teachings? Sometimes people think that's a real Buddhism. Let's talk about emptiness, non-duality. So the ending of things, nibbana. And sometimes people think that's two different types of teachings. Now when we talk about sort of sometimes what I mistakenly call here the higher Dhamma. But a lot of that time's a theory is no different than the practice. The practice is no different than the theory. Because if the theory cannot be put into practice, it is wrong theory. It's not worth anything. If the practice doesn't lead to insight, then it's wrong practice. The two always go together. Here's the first of the similes which came from, again, my own experience. I like to talk in terms of similes, anecdotes, simply because I realized a long time ago that life is a series of stories, a series of events. One doesn't live a theoretical life, one lives a life of anecdotes. That's why when you explain truths of life in terms of real stories, real events, it actually makes more sense because it is much closer to the truth of existence. Now we might think in the mind, but we actually live out here in the world of experience. And this is like a story I often use for meditation because it was profound, it affected me quite deeply, and it revealed to me sort of some of the reasons why samatha vipassana, calm and insight, setting things down and understanding, always go together. This is a simile of the road up to my monastery in Serpentine. Many of you, most of you, have been to visit that monastery, and you will know that when you go down the Southwest Highway, about 30 kilometers south of Armidale, that you turn left up this hill, this very steep, winding road, for about 2.2 kilometers before you come to our monastery. At the time this event happened, I'd been traveling up and down that road for about 5, 6, 7 years, I can't remember exactly how long, but always in a vehicle, in a car, in a van, driven by somebody else. But one day, I decided to walk up that hill. I don't know how many of you have been up and down that hill. I invite you next time you go there to walk up. Not only is it good exercise, but you'll find and discover what I discovered, which was that when I walked up that hill, it looked completely different than when I went up in a car. I was astounded by the fact that I'd been up and down that hill maybe hundreds, maybe even 1,000 times over those 6 or 7 years. But now it was as if I was going up a completely different hill. The scenery looked so much different. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. It was as if I didn't know that hillside at all. Then I stopped. As I stopped and stood still, the hillside looked different again. Much different than from when I was walking. It looked much richer, more beautiful, I saw more detail. The whole picture was more full. Whenever any event like that happens, the way of my training is always to reflect and find out what it was meaning and draw from those experiences some insights into the nature of the mind and the perception especially. And what I figured out very quickly was that when you're moving in a car, you only see flashes of the scenery. The mind, the senses, haven't got enough time to fully take in what's going on. And so that hillside looks quite grey and is not very detailed. You cannot have the time to fully take in everything which is happening. When I was walking, because you were going slower, the senses had more time. More input was actually going into the mind. So you began to see more deeply, more richly. When I stopped and stood still, you had all the time in the world. And when you had all the time in the world, that hillside, the trees, the bushes, the stream, the rocks, and the sky above had the full opportunity to imprint itself in your mind, and it looked the most beautiful when I stopped. The whole scene grew in richness, in depth, and also in beauty. And of course the simile was very clear. That is the same with the way we use our mind in life. So often it is just as if we're going through life in a fast car. From one experience to the next, from one thought to the next, from one place to the next. And because we're going so fast, all we see is the greyness of life. Because the images, the experiences, have got no chance to fully imprint themselves on our mind. We haven't got time to fully understand them. And certainly we don't see their richness, their depth, even their beauty. Because our mind is going too fast. So it becomes quite clear what one needs to do to be able to understand things, to solve problems, and also to see some of the richness of life, some of its beauty. And that is to slow down. To slow down means to calm the mind down. So instead of the mind running from one object to the next, from one thought to the next, being restless, like the simile of a monkey in the forest, always jumping from one tree to the next. And as that monkey is already jumping to the next branch, it's already planned the next two branches it's going to swing to. Just like each one of you, wherever you are, is already planning the next place you wish to go. And the whole idea of calming down is like doing one thing at a time and spending moments there instead of rushing always on to the next thing. Our life is very speedy. Because it is speedy, we never understand it, nor can we enjoy it. The more you slow down the mind, this is calm, 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 the slower the mind goes. As the mind goes slower, just like looking at a hillside, you see things in more depth, with more richness. You see more of what is going on. As you see more of what's going on, you get what we call insight, deep seeing into whatever one is looking at. If you can eventually stop, when there's a stopping, there is the full seeing. The same way when I stood next to that hillside, that's the time you saw it in its fullest color. You saw everything which was going on there. It was rich, informative, and also very beautiful. It is one of the extra side effects of samatha, of slowing down, is that life becomes more happy, more beautiful. Which is why that monks who practice calming down, why nuns who practice calming down, usually have a happier expression on their face. The faster you go, the more the edges of your mouth turn down. The slower you go, the more they turn up. It's the nature of samatha. Calm always leads to that happiness. But more importantly, it leads not just, that's a side effect, it leads to seeing deeply. And what you see deeply is not just the nature of the forest, you also see the nature of the mind, the nature of life, because life is reflected in your mind. So when I teach about how to solve life's problems, this is how to calm you down, how to start to go slower, so you understand for yourself not just the nature of problems, but the nature of the mind and the nature of all things. This is where insight comes, from solving the ordinary daily problems of your life. So let's get to that problem, like the boss from hell, or the or the partner from hell, or the body from hell when you're very sick and painful. First of all, what do we do when there's a problem in life? Let's get rid of it. Let's call the pest exterminator. When there's a cockroach in your house, get the pest exterminator, just zap them with some chemical. If you follow that path, the next time you get a partner you don't like, let's zap them. You know, if you can't get a chemical, at least with a divorce lawyer, let's get rid of them, let's exterminate them. Any pain in the body, zap them with some sort of magic bullet of chemicals. When there's anything we don't like in society, we call the pest exterminator, which is called ill will. That's the pest exterminator. And of course, many times, that's the way of our world. We get somebody we don't like, whether it's, you know, some terrorist organization or some person we don't like. Let's get the pest exterminator, stop it. Does that work? How many pests do you have to exterminate before you get happy, before you get free? The answer is, there's too many pests to exterminate. In fact, if you start exterminating pests, you become a pest yourself, and are also liable to extermination. One man's pest is another man's lover or whatever. So when we actually look at it this way, that idea of like extermination, getting rid of things we don't like, is not the way of calm, not the way of insight. Instead, we follow another way. In monasteries in Thailand, we learned this from a great teacher called my teacher Ajahn Chah. He was a great sort of leader by example and also by teaching. He would always say that whatever is irritating you, do not try and exterminate it, but learn from it. Of course, one of the most difficult of experiences in Thailand was dealing with the mosquitoes. Now, you may think mosquitoes are no problem, but you can imagine living in a jungle. 28 years ago, the monastery where I grew up was undeveloped. It was just a jungle. It was just the last remnant surrounded by paddy fields, but still old rainforest, in which so many mosquitoes lived. When the first year I was there, there was no mosquito repellent. There were no mosquito coils. Moreover, in that first year, we actually just slept out under the trees there. And in the evening, because there was a new monastery, our teacher Ajahn Chah would come every evening from his main monastery, just 6 kilometers away. He'd come every evening to do the evening chanting, and then to do an hour's meditation, followed by a talk. Now, while you were doing the chanting, you could always use your hands to try and brush the mosquitoes away. But once the meditation started, always at dusk, the very worst time for the mozzies. And you can see the way that monks are dressed. We've got so many exposed areas of skin, it's a mosquito's dream. Even got your bald head where they can get in. Now, many of you have got hair and they just can't get through there. Moreover, because you're Buddhists, you can't swat the mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes in Thailand know that genetically from their forebears. So whenever they see a monk, they know it's a free meal. That's why they hang around monasteries more than any other places. And secondly, that the mosquitoes in Thailand, over many centuries, have eaten Thai food for so long, when they see Western food, it's a delicacy. So they come for the Westerners. And this is no exaggeration. When we used to sit under the trees at dusk, with no protection at all, with Ajahn Chah and all the villagers, they were used to the mosquitoes. In fact, a lot of them wouldn't get bitten, they'd just go for the Westerners every time. We had to sit there, not used to mosquitoes. I was born in England. It's too cold for mosquitoes. Mosquitoes, they freeze there. But in Thailand, in the tropics, you'd sit there and the mosquitoes would start coming for you. And you just want to swat them, but you couldn't. You were a monk. You want to run away. But there was your teacher there and all these villagers were there and you feel such a fool. So with another monk, an American monk who I grew up with, we played a game. Our game was counting the mosquitoes when they were biting you to see who could count the most over that hour. It was a game we played. You used to get to about 40 or 50 at the same time when you literally couldn't count anymore because they were just too close together. And if you listened carefully, you could hear them slurp, slurp, slurp. Now that was an exaggeration, you couldn't hear them slurp. You would get to about 40 or 50 and you couldn't count anymore because you couldn't distinguish them on your body, they were just too close. Now that was very, very tough. And so sometimes we complain to Ajahn Chah. Say, look, can't we do something about this? It was just too hard. And this was one of the situations from hell, dealing with so many irritating mosquitoes all at the same time. So Ajahn Chah gave us one of our first teachings. He said, call the mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. Don't try and exterminate them. These beings are here to teach you something. That's what Ajahn means. Ajahn means teacher. So Ajahn Chah was like teacher Chah. Ajahn Brahm, teacher Brahm. Ajahn Wayama, teacher Wayama. That's what Ajahn means. So he said, this is Ajahn Mosquito, teacher mosquito. They're giving you a teaching, a sermon. Listen and stop trying to get rid of it. And that was actually turning the whole problem around. What he was saying, that even something so irritating, so hard to bear, was something you can learn from. And all the time, whenever we complain, the food is terrible, or we have to sit up so long, listen to these boring talks, because Ajahn Chah would go on all night sometimes. And all those books you read of Ajahn Chah, all those wonderful, inspiring sort of nuggets of wisdom, you'd have to wait sometimes 7 or 8 hours just to get one of those. And what the monks have done, they've sort of sifted out all of the, you know, the other stuff. They've just taken these nuggets of wisdom and put them in the book, so you get it very easy. Ajahn Chah wasn't like that at all. You'd have to listen for hours for one of those nice sayings. So sometimes, even the talks are very long. But he always tell you that these are teaching you something. So it's the same whenever you get an experience which is hard to bear. Always call it your teacher. You have to learn something there. First of all, what you're learning is something which in Buddhism we call the First Noble Truth. That life isn't meant to be easy. That life is suffering. You say, what do you expect out of life? Now, if your job was very easy and you really enjoyed it, then they wouldn't need to pay you. The payment is a bribe for having to do something you don't like. So always look upon your salary that way. It's a bribe for doing something you don't like. So don't expect yourself to enjoy your job. If you really enjoyed your job, you'd be someone like me who does it for nothing. So first of all, you can expect you're working because you don't like it. So don't expect to like it. So this is a bribe, especially if you have a big salary. If you have a big salary, you can expect big suffering. So first of all, expect. And it's the same with your body. How many of you expect to be healthy? And it's one of the biggest delusions created by a society which says you should be healthy. And if you don't be healthy, it's your fault. Now, you should go and see the doctor more often. You shouldn't eat so much fatty foods. Now, you should exercise more. Now, you should look after your diet. You shouldn't be so fat. My goodness, what a guilt trip we're in our society. What's wrong with being sick? So I rebel against society. I demand my right to be sick. So a lot of the times, because we have this attitude that we shouldn't be sick, we reject sickness and we put a lot of emotional and psychological problems around sickness, which actually makes it much worse. So even sickness is called Ajahn sickness. It's come here to teach you something. Even Ajahn death, when somebody dies or you die, is there to teach you a lesson. Teach you a lesson of impermanence. Things change. You're not always going to be young, fit and healthy. Those of you who are old, you're not always going to be old, sick and ugly. It's all going to change. You're going to die one day. It's all going to be over. Thank goodness. So what that these are teachers, is they're teaching us a lesson. What they're teaching us is that there's many things in life you can't change. So we learn just to accept. Fascinating that when we start to accept things rather than change things, some things you can change. Let's deal with that later on. When there's something you cannot change, you can't do anything about it, then what should you do? Nothing. That's why this idea of samatha is just so important, because as a society, as a modern culture, we're very good at doing things. We all know how to react. But how many people know, in a situation of pain, disturbance, being eaten by mosquitoes or whatever, how many of us know how to do nothing when life is tough? And this is one of the problems of our society. I think it was Blaise Pascal said that all the problems of mankind stem from not knowing how to sit still. That was about something in the 18th century sometimes. He was a smart guy. He sort of knew that it's because we don't know, we don't train in doing nothing. We know how to do something. There are times to do something. There's also times to sit still and do nothing. So if there's a boss from hell, a body from hell, mosquitoes, and you can't do anything about it, then sit still and do nothing. Something radically changes then. What changes is the mental part of the suffering disappears. The Buddha said there's two parts to pain, two parts to suffering. The physical part, out there in the world, and the mental part, your reaction to it. And this is a teaching of the Buddha himself. He said, so often, the physical part out there in the world, whether it's the boss from hell, the body from hell, the mosquitoes, or the economic situation, or whatever, so often we can't do anything about that. But we can do something about our reaction in our mind. How we respond to it. How we relate to it. Emotionally, spiritually. He said, that's where you've got full control. You can always let it alone, let it go. And be at peace. Even with great pain, with great disappointment, with whatever. And this was a great skill of the Buddha. It's actually to show, not just in theory, but in practice, how you can deal with these problems. Now look, if you've got a boss from hell, or a partner from hell, or an enemy, why are they acting that way? This is basic psychology, which, you know, is said here many times, which you should recognize through your mindfulness practice. When you start to slow down, and stop running away from the problem, but actually slow down, stop and face it, you see it more richly, like seeing the side of the hillside on the way to our monastery, and you start to understand exactly what's going on. And with that understanding comes the right response. Bosses from hell, partners from hell, people who really sort of start to upset you, they're doing that because they want a response. They want to upset you, irritate you, make you suffer. A lot of the times it's because they're suffering themselves, because they're really upset, they're really angry, or something is getting at them. And they want to make other people upset too. Look at that in your own life. When you have a hard day, when you're upset, when you're having a terrible time, why do you get angry at others, especially angry at people you live with? A lot of time it's because we want to share our pain. We're hurting, we want to give hurt to others. That's the psychology of the human being. We're happy, we want to give happiness to others. That's when you're in a good mood, you want to cheer everyone else up. So when you see where it's coming from, you will always be able to know that anyone who gives you a hard time is having a terrible hard time themselves. Please know that. It's not something you have done. So often people come up and say that, why are they so hard to me? Why are they so terrible to me? I haven't done anything. And it's true you haven't done anything. It's because they're hurting. That's why they want to hurt others. So, when they have that attitude towards you, when you know that the boss from hell or the partner from hell wants to make you upset and angry, just sit there peacefully. Do not respond to anger with more anger. One of the most powerful of the Buddha's teachings, which is in the Dhammapada, which many Buddhists know, is anger, hatred does not cease, is not solved with more anger and hatred. It's only stopped by love and forgiveness. It's the only way to stop anger and hatred. That's why I said, I think the last talk I gave here, 3 or 4 weeks ago, on conflicts and things like the Bali bombing and terrorists. What do terrorists want out of their victims? They want to get you really upset and angry. They want to hurt people, take away their happiness. And as a Buddhist response, say, it doesn't matter what they do, we refuse to have our happiness taken away. Refuse to have our freedoms taken away. Refuse to be controlled by the silly actions of others. That is a Buddhist response. Anger does not cease by giving anger back. Hatred doesn't cease by giving hatred back. A good example of this, which I want to bring up now, because this was somebody called me today, because there was an article in The Australian recently about while I was off in Melbourne, there was a Miss World contest in Nigeria. Apparently the Muslim community really objected to an article in the newspaper who said something like the Prophet Muhammad would have probably married one of the contestants. And that caused a riot in which many, many people got killed. And apparently that was taken up in an Australian magazine, Australian newspaper, where one of the journalists made a little joke about not just the Prophet Muhammad, but the Buddha observing one of the beauty contests and having a discussion between them which one they fancied. And many of the Buddhists, or some of the Buddhists, said, well, how should we respond to this? This is just really being derogatory to Buddhism. And so I had to tell this person, look, keep it cool. Don't worry about such things. You don't sort of destroy Buddhism, you know, by sort of writing in a jokey fashion about the Buddha, about the monks. In fact, I'm saying that as Buddhism becomes more popular in, say, a Western setting, as more people become Buddhist, there will be more people telling jokes about Buddhism. And sooner or later, we'll have, like, you know, sitcoms and comedies, you know, like sort of, you know, Up the Monastery or whatever else, you know, with sort of comedians playing the monks. It's only a matter of time, because, you know, that's what's happened to Christianity. You know, that we sort of, it's our tradition almost actually to poke fun at some of the stupid and ridiculous parts of everything. And I think sometimes that can be quite healthy. And so, what should we do as Buddhists when people do this? Just be quiet and enjoy the joke. Because a lot of times if someone is really being malicious, they want to try and get a response. And if they're trying to sort of create havoc, then at least they can sort of say anything they like about the icons, but they can't say anything or do anything about what those icons are pointing to, which is peace, compassion, tolerance, happiness, harmony. I don't know what you say about the Buddha. I'm still going to be kind and peaceful towards you. That's why, again, the response of the Buddhists to the blowing up of the Bamiyan statues was wonderful. They could blow up the Bamiyan Buddha statues, but they never destroyed the Buddhist principles of peace and tolerance. It doesn't matter about blowing up the statues, we can always make more. But, you know, if you build up hatred and you blow up the principles, you know, that which makes sort of people calm, loving, peaceful, then that you'd be very disturbed about. So this is the way we respond to problems in the world. Don't respond to the problems by throwing away the principles. And the principles are, you know, just peace, harmony, compassion. It's, especially if you've got a boss from hell, try those things. Peace, harmony, compassion. If you've got a partner from hell, peace, harmony, compassion. If you've got a body from hell, peace, harmony, compassion. Can you do that? My goodness, that is actually completely rebellious. Because a boss from hell wants to upset you. You refuse to get upset. Say whatever you want to say. Fine, by me, I don't agree with it, but why should I get upset by it? Whatever you ask me to do, you might ask me to shout at me to get all these things done today. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to do it at my pace, as best I can do. If you don't like that, fine, I'll even get another job somewhere else. But you just try your best, but you don't allow other people to control your pace of life, your emotions, your happiness. Too often in life that we allow life to control us, people to control us, our partner from hell to control us, or even our body to control us. As the Buddha said, that even though the body may be sick, the mind doesn't need to be sick. Even though you may have a boss from hell, your mind doesn't have to go to hell with them. Even though that life may be difficult, the mind can be at peace, even amidst all of that. This is the way we do it. During the meditation, I gave them some tricks, some insights into actually how to do this, how to be at peace. One of those insights is, whatever is happening in the present moment, allow it to be. Not just letting it go just with a sense of equanimity, but actually inviting in, welcoming it. Boss from hell, thank you for being there. Now you try that, that's radical. What that's actually doing is you're taking away the mental attitude of rejection. Welcome. Come in. That's what Ajahn Chah was implying. You're the teacher. You're a tough teacher, but I'm going to learn something from you. Welcome. Come in. When you have that attitude, first of all, instead of running away from the problem, you're facing it. Number two, you're responding in such a way, which completely undermines the reason why that boss is reacting to you in that way. You're undermining his strategy. It's fascinating when that happens. Fascinating when you don't respond in the normal, senseless ways of the world. The normal, senseless ways of the world. You've hurt me, I've got to hurt you back. You're oppressing me, I've got to stand my ground. I can't let anyone walk over me. That sort of attitude you find will not work. The other way is just, you are in control of your happiness and pain. It's up to you. Whatever they say, why should you allow what other people say to control your peace of mind? As a monk, people said all sorts of stupid things to me. They called me a girl. They called me sort of a bludger. Why don't I get a proper job? They call me a deviant because I'm celibate. They call me all sorts of things. All sorts of things. And so, a lot of times when they call you those names, you just laugh. You enjoy the joke. Some of the times it's very funny. I always remember the time when we were staying in North Perth many, many years ago. And this, about 12 or 13 year old girl came out from the house. She'd never seen a monk before. And she came right up to me. And she did this marvelous impression of someone who was absolutely disgusted. She looked me up and down, sniffing. And then she looked me straight in the eye and said, "You're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck." I thought it was so funny. I really thanked her for giving me another story to tell in my talks. But she was... Because I didn't get upset when she said that, that completely undermined her whole strategy. Why would you actually say that? You know, look someone up and down with real disgust and say, "You're dressed like a girl. That's it. Yuck." You're doing that to try and upset somebody. And the last thing you expect is to have them sort of enjoy the joke and laugh and be at peace. You know, it's true. I'm dressed like a girl. I've got a skirt on, haven't I? It's just our robes, that's all. That's why I keep telling people when I go travelling, go to the airport, sometimes they're different languages and don't know which actually toilet to go in because I look at the signs. That's only joking, I know. I don't get into trouble. But, so when people try to abuse you, what are they doing that for? They're trying to upset you. They're trying to take away the control of your own happiness. So that when this journalist started to make jokes about the Buddha or the Prophet Muhammad, what do journalists want? They want notoriety, don't they? They want people to read their newspapers. The most they want is to make some sort of big scandal about it. So they're famous. So it's great, okay, you can say whatever you like. Just ignore it. Be at peace with it. If it's a good joke, enjoy it. Laugh with it. And that way you're not allowing people to control your happiness. Your body. Why do you allow your body to control your happiness? Sometimes you're sick, sometimes you're healthy. Who can control sickness and health? Who wants to be healthy? Can you do it? Even if you've got the best doctors in the world, and you've got a gym in your own house, and you eat the best health foods, and you come to the Buddhist society every Friday night to do meditation, you're still going to get sick. So, it's really stupid, isn't it? So we always want to be healthy, but we can't do it. Why? So look, you've got to accept sickness as part of life. You're not going to avoid that. Same as old age, ugliness, and becoming smelly. You're not going to be able to avoid that as well either. So this is part of life. So if we can't avoid this, what do? We become to learn, take these things as our ajahns, as our teacher. And we can actually learn, because we don't fight it, because, obviously this is something we can do it. But a lot of times we can't. If what we can't fight, we call our teacher. Much more than sort of the teacher of the Buddha. Not more than any sort of teacher Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Brahm Chittamala or Ajahn Wayama. The greatest teacher for you is that which is very hard to bear. That's teaching you the big lessons. Learning how to be at peace with all of these things. It's amazing what happens when, even in a sick body, you say, okay, can't do anything about it. I'm just going to be at peace with this. I'm going to allow it to be. I'm just going to be with this sickness. And I'm not going to try and get rid of it. I gave that instruction, be in the present moment and see if you can develop non-negativity towards the present moment. Don't try and push it away. Don't try and reject it. This is your gift. It's present. That's what present moment means. This moment is there for you. Even the pain and the sickness. And anyone who's truly done this has not rejected the pain, not rejected the disappointment, but brought it all in, you find an amazing thing always happens every time. The pain doesn't go. The problem doesn't disappear. But the mind becomes so peaceful that it's not a problem anymore. It's not a pain anymore. It's just feeling. It's just life. It's just business, that's all. What do you expect in business? This is just life. So you're at peace with things which you cannot change. You find then you've got a marvelous teaching, a way of dealing with so many different problems in life. So often in life, is I don't like this, I don't want this, it shouldn't be happening to me, why me? That moaning, fault-finding mind is one of the biggest problems, psychological problems of our life. That psychological problem, I want it to be different. I want it to be different. And we get into that so much. There's times where we can change things. Great. But you all know how to do that. That's why so often I emphasize how to be at peace with things. Sometimes people misunderstand me, or all the monks now I'm staying here, thinking that we should just be pacifists all the time. We do nothing and don't stand up for anything. But that's not what I mean. We're just emphasizing so the non-reaction, because we all know how to do the other thing, to change, manipulate, control, do things in life. We all know how sort of to be managers and administrators. Here I'm saying is how we can just let go and be at peace. You ever notice when the traffic lights fail, the traffic goes very smoothly through the traffic systems of a city? When there's no control, things flow much more smoothly. So often in life, when we let go, things flow so much more smoothly. It's also, if you've got a boss from hell, a body from hell, so often those boss from hell, again, is doing this to, is his way of trying to control you. When you refuse to get controlled by that, you become free. A simile of freedom, which I tell very often, the simile that every place where you don't want to be is called a prison. That's the definition of the word jail. Any place you don't want to be. Freedom is any place where you're content to be. That's why being in a monastery like ours in Serpentine, or a sister's monastery, if any of you ever go to visit prison, you find the conditions in our monasteries are much, much worse than the conditions in any prison in this state. That's why I always hope there's nobody from Amnesty International here, otherwise the Buddhist Society of Western Australia will be put on the list of abusing their monks and nuns by not giving them three meals a day, televisions and everything else. I did actually hear this in the Centrelink, Department of Social Security in Britain. They decided that everyone should have a video and TV. So even poor people actually get given them for free, because you're deprived if you haven't got these things. So we're all deprived in our monastery. We're all way below the poverty level, the way we live. In fact, so hopefully there's nobody from Amnesty International here, otherwise we get cited for abuse of our sangha. But nevertheless, why in our monastery it's actually so hard to get in there, to even come for a visit. Monks' quarters, our men's quarters, women's quarters are all booked up. The monks even come to the monastery, they have to book up, you know, sometimes years in advance. We're already full for next year, we can't take any more monks even from overseas. Actually, this is interesting, the ladies' quarters, now we've got three rooms in our ladies' quarters in Bodhinyana Monastery. And for the rains retreat, you can actually stay 3 months there if you book up in advance, but 2003 is already booked up with a waiting list. So is 2004 as well. 2005 was booked up 3 weeks ago, and now I've already got two rooms booked up for 2006. It's crazy, isn't it? Sort of people booking up for, look, that's 4 years in advance. My goodness. No hotel sort of books up that far in advance. But why is that? Why do people come up there just to do nothing? No TV, no sport, no radio, only a couple of meals a day. You've got to just eat what you're given. Situation's very harsh there. Much harsher than the prison. Who would actually book up to go to prison 3 or 4 years in advance? So why is it that people actually do this? The reason is because people want to be there. In a prison, doesn't matter how luxurious you make a prison, even if you turn the Hilton Hotel in Perth into a security prison, put all the prisoners in there, they still want to escape. Why is that? Because they don't want to be there. That's what a prison means. If you understand that point, the difference between a prison and freedom, you understand a lot about Buddhism. You understand a lot about how to deal with problems in life. You understand a lot about the nature of the world and Dhamma. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. Any place where you're content is freedom. So if you got the boss from hell, and you say, he's my teacher, I'm content to have him. Thank you so much for teaching me just patience, teaching me endurance, teaching me how to respond to difficult situations. Oh, it's so wonderful to have you. I heard that once from Ajahn Sumedho, who went to this monastery once, who had this really terrible monk he had to sit next to for 3 months. He was a gross monk. And at the end of the 3 months, Ajahn Sumedho actually went to him to thank him for his company. And this monk sort of thought, this is a really sort of good Western monk, he really appreciates my wisdom. And Ajahn Sumedho said, he wasn't appreciating his wisdom. He was just appreciating for being just a terrible monk, this monk from hell for 3 months, because he taught him so much. Thank you for being such a rotter. Because that's how we learn sometimes, from the really hard teachers. So he learned about freedom. It doesn't matter about changing all the monks in your monastery to be perfect monks. It doesn't matter about changing your partner in life to be this wonderful partner from heaven, your soulmate, the most perfect husband in the whole world, who's just willing just to get up in the morning and serve you all day, and just would almost like bow to you and worship you all day and say what wonderful things to you. So the perfect partner, you'd never learn anything from those. You just get more dumb and stupid than you are already. So the best thing to do is just have these partners from hell you really learn from and say, so thank you for teaching me so much about the reality of life and how about freedom is. If you want to be there, you're free. Same with your body. If ever you're in great pain and sickness, you say, I don't want to be here, I want to die, then you're in prison. I can't stand this any longer. You're in the torture chambers of prison. How do you get out? You don't need to break through any doors or walls. All you need to do is say, I am content to be here. Then you have all the freedom you wish. One of my favorite monks, a Thai monk, many years ago, he's dead now, but he got convicted of being a communist in the times of the communist scares in many parts of Asia and Europe and the United States. So he got put in jail for 2 years. He wasn't a communist, but sometimes you can give a talk. If you give so many talks in public, sooner or later you'll say something which somebody, some smart lawyer or judge would actually take as you're a communist or a socialist or whatever they want to find out you are. So this monk was put in jail for 2 years, just for no good reason at all. He was so happy. For 2 years he didn't have to give any talks. He didn't need to see people who had their problems, didn't do any counseling. He had all this free time. He got up early in the morning, and actually the prison food was actually sometimes even better than the food you get in the monastery. And he had all this time for himself. He could read, He could meditate, had nothing to do. He said the best 2 years of his life. Marvelous, it's like solitary confinement. No, I did 6 months, I had to work hard for that, but in prison you get it for free. So if a monk were in jail, the last thing they'd do to punish you is to give you solitary confinement, because that's what you want. So this is actually learning how to be free. When you want to be there, when you're content to be there, how can you call it a prison? That contentment, that letting go, that being with rather than being against, is how to be free when you're in terrible pain, when you're about to die with a partner from hell or the boss from hell. You're teaching me something very, very powerful, because you may be able to get rid of the boss from hell, you may even be able to get rid of the partner from hell, but you'll never be able to get rid of this body from hell, which is always getting sicker and older, day by day. And eventually going to pack up on you and die. A lot of times, death is painful. And that's something you can't get rid of. You're actually learning how to deal with the hard stuff of life. There are many disappointments that you have in life, many tragedies you have to deal with in life. And sometimes it's somebody else. One day it will be us, when we learn how to deal with these things by being content, even where other people would be sort of rushing up and down, screaming, complaining. I'm so proud of many Buddhists I've known who, when they've been told they've got cancer, have had this marvelous sense of contentment. Many people I've known who've been dying, who've been at peace dying, who have been content, who haven't been fighting to the very end. My goodness, they've died gracefully. They've been an inspiration to themselves and to others. That was their teacher, Ajahn Cancer, Ajahn Death, something they couldn't change. They dealt with so beautifully, so peacefully. This is things in life we can't do anything about. Call it Ajahn. Learn from it and see if you can look upon it not as a prison, but as freedom, by not changing the outside, but by changing one's attitude. Letting go, letting be. Now, before anyone actually asks the questions of what happens, shouldn't you sometimes do things? Shouldn't you actually sometimes complain? Shouldn't you actually take the medicine? Of course you should. Try that out. If there's a possibility to talk to the boss from hell, to invite him actually to come to the Buddhist Society to actually to learn some Dhamma. Great. It's good for him. You know, leave him a few sort of Buddhist propaganda. So, you know, get a few tapes, you know, leave a few books around. Because a lot of times actually people realize they're suffering, they do sometimes want some help. If it's the right time and place, it's amazing just how people can actually say, oh, I'm interested in that, thank you very much. As long as it's the right time and the right place and the right way of doing things. Sometimes that might help. Or sometimes showing by example, by being kind back to the boss or the partner from hell. So often you can actually change people. One of the great ways of doing something, changing, is what we call positive reinforcement, which I've taught a lot about here. Forgive the faults, praise the goodness. Every time your boss from hell does something which is reasonable, which is kind, which you like, praise it. Make sure they recognize that it's appreciated. Everybody loves to be praised. They love to be flattered. And what they get praised for, they tend to repeat. So actually, by praising the good qualities in another person, by flattering them, you actually encourage them. This is the way you can actually encourage the boss from hell to become a kind boss. By forgiving all their faults, by praising their good points. That's the way we change ourselves. How many of you are your own boss from hell? Always on your own back, asking you to do things you can never really achieve, giving you deadlines which you just cannot meet, and whenever you even make a small mistake, they really get on your back, not just for one day, day after day after day. You stupid idiot, why can't you do this right? You know, you should do much better than this. And how many times do I have to tell you, you're so idiot, stupid. The boss from hell inside, I think you can all recognize the boss from hell inside. That boss from hell inside, how do you deal with that? Release that one by praising your good qualities, encouraging them. That way, you find that you can become a better person. This is what we do to change others, what we do to change ourselves, what we do to change life. Praise all the good qualities in life. Forgive all the bad. That's why the Buddha said, hatred is not ceased, is not stopped with more hatred. It's only ceased by forgiveness, love, understanding, quietening it down, calming the problem. And there you have insight. Understanding not just how to deal with the boss from hell, not just how to deal with the body from hell, not even how to deal with you from hell. Learning how to deal with everything. That's why we get these amazing insights and wisdom, Buddha teachings, about the nature of you, how you work, the nature of life. And whatever wisdom there is, even the deepest, highest wisdom, if you cannot put it into practice in your daily life to stop suffering, it's not wisdom. All of the profound teachings of the world, if they don't actually work in daily life, they're all just airy-fairy stuff and nonsense. Just like theological babble. But if it's really wisdom, it's something which not just the monks can make use of in their monasteries, in high meditation. It's what even the ordinary person should be able to make use of and to change their life. That's what wisdom is. That's what calm is. And those are some insights into how to deal with the boss from hell, the partner from hell, the body from hell, or even when you are from hell. So I hope you enjoyed that talk this evening, and I hope there's some insights which you can take home with you to become better people for the happiness of yourself and all those who have to put up with you. Thank you. So any questions about the talk this evening? Questions, comments, or complaints? Yes. Okay. First of all, you say that some people have suffered for millions of years and they still sort of aren't any the wiser. A lot of times it's because people run away from suffering rather than face up to it and learn from it. Okay, sometimes people have heard those teachings before, but they don't practice them. They don't actually put them into practice. It's okay like reading menus, but if you don't eat the food, you know, you never stop getting hungry. So all those teachings are actually... This is certainly my experience in life. They work if you actually put them into practice. But a lot of times that sometimes they're hard to be put into practice because they're radical. They go against what one has learned before. They go against the way of the world. They go against the stream. They take courage to do. And sometimes people haven't got the courage to let go of their controller, their control freak inside. It takes a lot of guts, actually, to when you're in great pain, to let go. It takes a lot of guts to allow yourself to die because of the attachment we have to me and the body and mine. But eventually we suffer until we learn that that's a way which ends suffering. That's true what you say, people suffer because they never actually practice and understand those teachings. There's a difference between theoretical understanding, putting them into practice and finding they work, and get the experiential understanding. That's why it's very easy to study Buddhism. It's very easy to actually to write books about Buddhism. But actually to practice it first of all, actually to follow that path and realize that path, that's a hard thing to do. And really only then are you really qualified to talk about Buddhism. So that's one of the reasons why people like they suffer, and they keep on suffering, because they don't really learn. Why? Get to the heart of the matter and give those teachers a chance just to let go. Be at peace, be content with where you are. Then you have all the freedom you want in the world. You find you don't need to go anywhere or change anything. You'll be so free. Sometimes you look at all the rules I have to keep, but I can't do this, I can't do that. You know, I've got sometimes my whole day is just filled up with my duties. I haven't even a chance to rest. I feel so free. Sometimes you have to go and give all these talks all over the place, and sometimes, you know, from early morning to late at night. But I always, if ever I get sort of bitchy at myself, why do I have to do this? Why me? Why do I have to do all these things? So that's not the right way, Ajahn Brahm. Be content, enjoy it. So when I actually do that and being content, being enjoy that, I never used to like going to the dentist. But now I think it's a marvellous going to the dentist because, you know, when you sit back on that, first of all, the chair in the dentist is much more comfortable than any chair we've got in our monastery. You really lie back there. Number two, they put all this stuff in your mouth and no one can ask you any questions. So it's one time in my life I could really be peaceful. So I just let them do whatever they want to do in my mouth. This is my half an hour, I can just really meditate. It's great being in the dentist. So number two is just the Buddha. So he became enlightened. He had to suffer, first of all. The suffering was teaching me to try to find a way out through controlling. And after a while, he just let go. And he became enlightened. There's lovely stories in Buddhism. One of the stories I tell on all the meditation retreats, towards the very end of the meditation retreat, was of this nun, this bhikkhuni in the time of the Buddha, called Siha. She'd been 7 years in the monastery, and never once could she get any peace in her meditation. She didn't want to go back to the world, and especially India in those days, having to be a cook and a slave to your husband, basically. They always used to say that this is actually from the Terigata, the verses of the nuns. Many of them said that when they became a nun, they gave up three crooked things. The three crooked things they gave up was the soup ladle, which was a symbol of their cooking. The third crooked thing they gave up was the broom, the sweeping, which is another symbol of their housework. The third crooked thing they gave up was their husband. I don't need to explain that symbol to you. So they were so free, they gave up three crooked things. And she didn't want to go back to the three crooked things, but she couldn't get any peace in monastic life. So she took a rope to the forest, tied one end of the rope to a tree branch, the other around her neck, and she was about to jump off. And that moment, just before she jumped off, that's where she had an enlightenment experience. You know why? Because the first time in her life, she let go. She gave up. She gave up all this trying to be enlightened. And when she let go, that's when it happened. It's a simile which I give in retreats of how to catch a carrot if you're a donkey. You know, in many places in Europe, maybe 50, 60 years ago, they always used to have these donkey carts. And now donkeys are notoriously stubborn. The only way they can get them to move is they tie a stick to their back, and the stick is maybe a foot in front of them, and they hang a carrot on a string in front of the stick. So, the donkey always walks towards the carrot, trying to get the carrot. But the carrot always moves further away from the donkey. That's the way they get the donkey to move. But when the donkey gets insight, good when they're meditators, they get good Buddhist insight, they know how to catch the carrot. You know how they catch the carrot? The donkey starts to run as fast as it possibly can. But of course, as fast as the donkey runs, the carrot goes even faster in front of it. So sometimes that's like our life. Sometimes we're trying to trace enlightenment. The faster we run after it, the further it gets away. But this donkey is smart. It runs as fast as any donkey has ever run before, and then it suddenly stops. Now when it stops, you've got to have a lot of courage and faith, because when you stop, the carrot goes even further away from you, as it swings because of the momentum. But if the donkey has insight, don't need to run, don't do anything, just be still, and it goes so far away, it's never been that far away in life before. But then it starts to come back. Come back, come back, come back, and then it swings closer than it's ever been before. In fact, it swings right into the mouth of the donkey. That's how the donkey catches a carrot. And that's how you catch enlightenment. You try, run as fast as you can, and then suddenly you stop. Let go, give up. When you first do that, it's as if the carrot, enlightenment, truth, peace, gets further and further away from you. But have faith. Shh. It goes so far away, and then, almost miraculously, it starts coming back. Enlightenment comes to you. Until it comes so close, you catch it. That's how the Buddha became enlightened. I hope you enjoyed the talk. And again, I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time about Christmas time after my sojourn in Malaysia and Cambodia. Yeah. Oh yeah, the Bangladesh. I'm so sorry. Okay. Every year it's getting very close to Christmas or Buddhamas, depending on how you want to pronounce that. And lots of times this is always a season for goodwill and kindness and love and generosity. And every year, instead of looking after our own backyard, our Buddhist society, every year we do a little appeal for an orphanage which is in Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world. And it's still the girls' orphanage, isn't it? Girls and boys, these are Buddhists in a Muslim country in Bangladesh. Basically, they're the bottom of the heap. And we've been sending money to this place for a lot of years. And Judy has actually gone to visit the place to make sure that any sort of funds we send are actually used. And if you have any doubts at all, you can go and ask her. There's pictures out in the back on the board over there. And actually, what they spend the money on, it just really almost sort of makes you cry. It's on like rice. It's on like beds so you can sleep on. And like blankets. And just no luxuries at all. Just basic necessities of life. So every cent which we collect for this is all sent for feeding kids, orphans. Orphans and educating them. So this is our one little project which we do in our Buddhist society for poor kids in Bangladesh, which we look after. So if anyone wishes to send a present to somebody at Christmas time, you can actually do that. There's no tax concessions at all. You don't get any benefit out of this, except knowing that it's something good for somebody else. So I don't mind pushing that, because it's good karma to encourage other people to do good karma. I don't get anything out of it myself. It's just happiness that it's one way I can actually help serve the little kids. There's pictures on the board over there. It's real. It's not any scam, because we look after this and we send people. Are you going to go over there again, Judy, soon? Next year, so you're going to go over there again to, again, check out everything is done well.